December 18th, 1989, Bob Stack interviewing Bob Estabrook. Firstly, if I might, I would ask you to state your full formal name.
All right. My name is Robert Harley Estabrook.
Okay. Let's start then by getting right into the railroads and covering that material in depth.
Good.
You go right.
Well, I think it should be understood that railroads happen to be a hobby of mine, but all of this took place before I came to Lakeville in the northwest corner. So all of the little I know about it is derived from reading or from talking with people who were here. The first railroad to hit the northwest corner was, of course, the Housatonic Railroad, which came through Canaan as early as 1841, very early in the history of American railroads. It went north from Bridgeport and Hawleyville and ultimately went to South Lee, Mass., and then to Pittsfield and finally to North Adams. Very important carrier in the early days, ultimately absorbed by the New Haven Railroad and then finally into Conrail and, it was the Penn Central first and then Conrail. And the Housatonic Railroad lasted as a passenger line until April 1971. I remember when they had the last Bud car come through Canaan. And then the freight service lasted another 4 or 5 years and then was just gradually suspended. There was an effort to abandon the line, but the state of Connecticut under Governor Grasso, in a really forethoughted piece of action, bought the right-of-way and rail banked it. And this meant that
rail bank,
which meant that it was available for whatever future use the public need might dictate, but the right-of-way was there. Well, in point of fact, the track was in relatively good condition, and this Housatonic Railroad, two words, 4 or 5 years ago, started to rehabilitate it for a scenic line, with the idea always, I think, of establishing a bridge freight service, of building up bridge traffic from New Milford north to South Lee, or the main east-west line of the old Boston and Albany. The Harlem Valley line of the New York Central, later Penn Central, came north somewhat later, but not very much later, in the middle of the Harlem Valley, and it existed in the 1850s. And one occasion on which it was used was to bring spectators up for a prize fight at Boston Corners, when Boston Corners was in no man's land. This was in the 1850s, after the state of Massachusetts had concluded that it could not exercise law and order west of the main range of the mountains here, so it ceded the little portion extending into the Harlem Valley to New York State. But New York didn't get around to accepting it for 6 or 7 years, and so this was literally a no man's land. And there was a prize fight in the mid-1850s that featured a 35-round bare-knuckle fight, with one contender being Yankee Sullivan. I forget who the other one was. All of this is covered in a book, I believe, Hell's Half Acre. But in any event, the miners from the top of Mount Riga came down to view the fight. And then the next railroad, and the one of particular interest to this area, was the Central New England, which started as the Hartford and Connecticut Western, and thereby gave the name to Connecticut Western. You see it in other things. But it came west from Hartford and passed through Lakeville-Salisbury in 1871, and at the same time the glorious Canaan Union Station was built. It went on west, ultimately to Poughkeepsie, and first there was, of course, a ferry across the Hudson, but ultimately the Poughkeepsie Bridge was built. It went over to a place called Campbell Hall, New York, where it joined the ill-fated New York, Ontario, and Western. No one knows of the New York, Ontario, and Western these days, but it once was an important bridge carrier, and traffic from through Lakeville ultimately ended in Chicago. And what was the Hartford and Connecticut Western subsequently became known as the Central New England. For a period in the 1890s, the Philadelphia and Reading bought it, and so it was part of the Reading system. It was a sort of unlucky railroad in a lot of ways. It took 64 and a half miles to go the 50 airline miles between Hartford and Lakeville because of all the curves in the mountains. And it got over the summit in Norfolk, southeast of Norfolk, at about 1,400 feet. And this required helper locomotives in each direction, coming from Winsted west or from East Canaan going east. I don't suppose the Central New England ever owned a piece of vestibuled steel passenger equipment in its life. They were all old, unvestibuled, open platform cars hauled by steam locomotives. And while the railroad prospered as a carrier, particularly of anthracite coal from Pennsylvania, it came over to Campbell Hall and then went through to Hartford and then on east on other lines of the New Haven to industries in New England, this began to die out with the increasing use of oil. In 1905, I saw the statistic, there were 200 freight cars coming through Lakeville every day. And in World War I, it was common to have 100-car freight trains pulled by double headers, and most of that was anthracite coal and hopper cars groaning over the summit to Hartford. The railroad in the teens, in 1910 on, ran six, and I think at one time, eight passenger trains each way a day. Of various sorts. They weren't all through trains. At one point, you could get on a parlor car in Norfolk and ride through to Grand Central Station in New York without change. And I've seen promotion brochures from the 1890s that advertised the pure air and water of the Taconic Mountains reachable through the central New England, with the implication, at least, that there might have been sleeping car service here. I have not found any direct reference to it. I do have a friend who went to Maine one time and remembers waking up in a sleeping car in Lakeville and seeing the station before the Hell Gate Bridge was built in New York. And this obviously had to be a train that was detoured for some reason over the central New England, but it did happen. The passenger service, although it prevailed during World War I very heavily, began to decline shortly thereafter because of the highway system, the advent of the automobile and buses and so on. And for a little while, the Central New England experimented with running gas cars. It was a four-wheeled bus with a gasoline engine and radiator on front. I've seen pictures of them, and it was an ungainly device. But it didn't last very long, and in 1927, the last through passenger service on the railroad ended, and that was the last passenger service to Lakeville. Curiously, the stub end to Salisbury and Lakeville lasted as a freight line until 1965. The New Haven had, by that time, long since acquired the central New England. It was a part of the New Haven, and it... The New Haven continued freight service as long as this was considered viable. The roadbed was not in very good condition, but I've read the story of the last train to Lakeville. Portions of it over in New York State lingered on because of various state transportation requirements, and there was a mixed train that went from Copaic to Stissing Junction after that, and that sort of thing. I also read in the Lakeville Journal of a steam locomotive that tried to make it from Lakeville west to Millerton. This was on the freight track in the mid or late 1930s, and the grass was so high that the engine got stalled, and the grass was slippery under the drive wheels, and they had to go back and get some sand in order to complete the trip. But the Central New England had its aficionados, and it still is a. It would be a wonderful walkway if this is all, or most of it's reverted to private property. But imagine being able to walk this line up over the summit of Norfolk. I should add that it went under Norfolk Green in a tunnel. The tunnel still exists there. You can see the portal right by the Norfolk Library. It's been blocked shut so kids won't get lost in it and so forth. But it's there.
Gee, Wes, that's a fascinating, really fascinating story. Do you think that the railroad will come back?
Oh, I wish I thought so, but one of the really monumental pieces of foolishness was to let the Harlem Valley Line go in the mid-1970s and afterward. When we first came to Lakeville, you could ride to New York on a four-car train pulled by diesel locomotives from Millerton, and it was comfortable and very convenient. In the spring of 1972, the Penn Central, with its great flair for public relations, took the down train down from Millerton, abandoned all passenger service at noon, and stranded everyone in New York. In fairness, I have to say they'd been making noises about doing this, but nobody thought it was actually going to happen. Letty Gay Carson did a yeoman job with the Harlem Valley Transportation Association of trying to revive the passenger service or keep the freight service going, but she could not prevail against a Penn Central management determined to get out of the short line, branch line freight business. It was moved by bigger high finance considerations, and B, the short-sightedness of some county and state officials at that time who simply couldn't see any use for the railroad. Now they wish they had found it.
Well, railroad transportation actually would be cheaper, wouldn't it?
Be enormously cheaper for long-haul stuff. Of course, this is what does go by very heavy loads now, and many of the lines that are making money have doubled the size of their rail, and they still pound it to pieces because they use much heavier roads than the highways will tolerate. But we, the taxpayers, have picked up the cost of the trucks pounding the pavement to pieces on the highways. This is a result of the Interstate Highway Act, which Eisenhower signed in the early 1950s, and then the end of the railway mail service, which no one thought was going to have the side effect of ending all branch line passenger service. As long as railroads had a mail contract, it at least broke even for them to attach a combination passenger coach onto the mail car and haul it to Copaic Falls or wherever they were going. And when that incentive ceased, the branch lines just went out of business one after the other.
I remember reading in Los Angeles that the tire companies and the bus or big truck companies and so on had a hand in helping to get rid of that, get rid of the streetcars and that kind of thing. Is there any evidence of...
Well, I don't know of any direct evidence. It wouldn't surprise me if the lobbies worked for that in Washington. You get a lobby for almost anything. I doubt that there was a sinister plan to do away with the streetcars, except streetcars generally were looked upon as inefficient, and here they are cumbersome, they're out in the middle of the street, and they're in your way, and they go slow, and they have this track that gets clogged and collects ice and all of that. Nobody thought of the other effects. The Bay Area Rapid Transit in San Francisco, Oakland is an example. There was a really marvelous system with tunnels and so forth, the key system that existed right into World War II, and it was abandoned during World War II. And within the last 8 or 10 years, they've had to rebuild a much, much less extensive, less efficient system, the Bay Area Rapid Transit, for billions of dollars. And, well, you can say that in almost any major city.
I was interested in following up on how you got involved with this railroad hobby.
Well, my paternal grandfather was president of the Barney and Smith Car Company in Dayton, Ohio, which made railroad cars and some very good ones, both passenger and freight cars, in the latter half of the 19th century into the 20th century. And I sort of grew up in the lore of this, and I remember my grandfather talking about it, and my father was able to fuss around the yards in a small steam switch engine, and he told me about it and that sort of thing, so I absorbed this as a hobby. And then I have done a bit of research on the central New England, on the lines around here. I have read wherever I could. And going through the files of the Lakeville Journal, it's amazing how much you do pick up from these things.
Oh, sure.
I mentioned the change in the quality of news that came about as a result of the demise of the railroad. For example, it's obvious that news traveled east and west through this area while the central New England was thriving. And John Jones shot a wildcat in Norfolk this morning, and the conductor on the train would tell the station agent at Lakeville, and the station agent would tell B.D. Jones, the editor of the Journal, and there'd be an item about a wildcat in Norfolk. We don't get that anymore because truck drivers are perfectly sociable beings, but they don't stop. They go on through. So you don't hear the little tidbits.
Yeah. There was a railroad station here in Lime Rock, too, wasn't there?
Lime Rock Station is actually across the river in Falls Village. It's right near where Ed Fales lives now, and it's off Warren Turnpike Road, but it was called Lime Rock Station. There was a Borden Creamery right near there that furnished some traffic for it. This brings up another part that we may want to talk about, which is the remnants of the iron industry, but the Barnum and Richardson Company in Lime Rock made railroad car wheels. And it made them until 1916, that relatively recently. It was the biggest operator in these parts, and I have never really had it explained to me why it was cheaper to load railroad car wheels on huge wagons and haul them on many horse teams over to the spur at Lime Rock Station than to build a spur into Lime Rock proper. I suppose it had to do with the grade. I think that probably it would have required too much power to get out of the Salmon Kill Valley or something like that. Anyhow, Barnum and Richardson made a lot of the armor for battleships and other vessels in the Spanish-American War. It operated, as I say, until 1916. It owned a lot of the forest lands in this area for charcoal. And an interesting byproduct, it owned most of the top of Canaan Mountain. Well, the Ted Childs, the forester, the present owner of Great Mountain Forest in Norfolk and Falls Village, has told me that his father was able to acquire this land from Barnum and Richardson, or from the executors, for $1 an acre. And this was in the late teens or early 20s. And we have this magnificent wilderness tract up there, which is glorious. It's the largest forest in Connecticut. We have to thank the iron industry and Barnum and Richardson for this.
In relation to the issue of acid rain, to what extent did the making of charcoal, the taking down of the trees and so on, did that contribute to the smoke pollution and so on?
Well, I'm sure the smoke was something horrendous in 100 years ago or more here. And I've read of how all the hillsides glowed with furnace fires and so forth at night. And I'm sure there was a tremendous amount of particulate matter in the atmosphere. We didn't measure it in those days. This was accepted as normal. And I suppose if we had been environmentally conscious, we never would have had an iron industry in this area. Because it's a dirty industry. And charcoal, I guess, is a dirty industry. The forests in the immediate vicinity had been long since denuded. And by 1910 or 1920, they were going out 50 miles or more for the wood. This was a major factor in the decline of the iron industry, apart from the fact that there were more efficient methods of smelting and that they were going to have to go deeper and farther for their ore and that sort of thing.
How far did they have to go for wood once they started?
Well, I understand that 50 or 55 miles out to get some of this, and of course the Ore Hill mine west of Lakeville was known for producing some of the richest ore this side of Sweden in that it had natural manganese in it. But they were going way down. One of those tunnels I saw, I'm told, is 275 feet deep. That's pretty deep. And they, along in the late teens, began running into water problems. They had pumps going all the time, but they couldn't keep the pump water out. And this is what ultimately killed the operation in the early 1920s. The hydrostatic pressure was so high that they just kept filling with water. The last iron operation in the area was at the East Keenan furnace, the Beckley furnace in East Keenan, which lasted actually until 1924. The Ore Hill mine was not at all used up in terms of the iron ore, and during World War II there was an effort to revive the mine, but they got pumps working and they never got the water level down more than about 3 feet, as I understand it. A few years ago, George Bushnell was telling me that when there was an effort to lower the level of Lake Winnetka-Pomuk, the level of the ore mine also dropped, so that it's obvious that there's an underground connection between these two.
Mm-hmm. There are five or six furnaces in this area.
Yes.
This one behind us here, is that one of the early ones?
Quite an early one, but I think it was also active during the Barnum Richardson days. This is the one in Lime Rock. The Salisbury Association back in the early 1960s restored the furnace up on top of Mount Riga, and this is visible up there. Those two and the Beckley furnace are the only ones that are well preserved. Not long after we moved here, the old Maltby furnace in Millerton, just across the state line on Belgo Road, fell down almost overnight. Vegetation had gotten into it, and one day it was standing, and the next day it was a heap of rubble.
Goodness. Yeah. What about the people who, the workers who got involved? You mentioned miners on Mount Riga.
You pronounce it any way you want. Lila Nash used to say Mount Riga, but most of those I know with some direct connection with it say Mount Riga, and it is the Mount Riga Association.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those workers up there who worked there, did they come in, or is there any truth in this story about Hessian soldiers, which you must have heard?
Well, I heard the story about Hessian soldiers. I've never seen any evidence of it at all. You may remember we were talking about Paul Rebillard's father the other day. He came from France, and he worked actually as a charcoal cutter on the mountain. There were some immigrants. I have never seen any evidence of anybody coming from Latvia that would give the Riga or Riga the name. I just don't believe that story. I know that there were some Cornish men imported. They had experience with mines in Cornwall, and some of them came as actual furnace operators or technical advisors. Bill Barnett's grandfather, I think, was one such person. I think one of the Bartles came as a technician here. There is no real indication I have seen that there was any large group of immigrants who came to work in the charcoal industry. There may well have been, but I just haven't read about it.
In this area, I remember Marcello told me in an interview, and also Hezekiah, that there were French and Italian workers.
Well, there were a lot of Italians who came to the Canaan area, of course, and we know about that there was some ethnic rivalry that figured in the secession of North Canaan from the town of Canaan in 1858. Not wholly that. It was just difficult for people in North Canaan to get to the churches and so forth in Falls Village, which was then the center. As it happened, though, the village of Canaan grew up in what is now the town of North Canaan. And as you know, we have a confusion of Canaans that is very hard for outsiders to understand.
Let's take a ride around.
Get yes. The part, yes. Yeah.
A comprehensive picture, Bob. Let's talk a little bit about your own background.
Yeah.
And let's start with what brought you to Salisbury. How did you first hear about Salisbury?
Well, I had spent 25 years on the Washington Post, and Mary Lou and I wanted something that we could do together. Our children were grown, the last children were in college, and I was at this point covering the United Nations and Canada, having previously been a foreign correspondent and editor of the editorial page in Washington. I saw the United Nations through its 25th anniversary, and as I say, I completed 25 years in the Washington Post, and this seemed a pretty good time to leave. We had been looking through New England for, well, first for a small daily newspaper, and we rapidly concluded that any small daily we could afford to buy wasn't the sort we wanted to own. But we had looked at some weeklies, and a colleague of mine, Russell Wiggins, the former editor of the Washington Post, who now publishes the Ellsworth American up in Maine, had been looking for me. We looked up there without really seeing anything that seemed to strike a chord. I answered an advertisement for two Southern New England weeklies, and it turned out that one of them was the Connecticut Western News in Canaan, and the other one was the Thomaston Express, and they were both owned by a man named Del Vaglio, who was in Litchfield. They had a printing plant in Litchfield. We went up to talk to him, and I became rapidly convinced that I didn't want anything to do with either of those. But he dropped in passing that Mr. Hoskins in Lakeville might want to sell. And so we drove through Canaan and Lakeville, and I picked up a copy of the journal and looked at it. And we had driven through the area before, but we're not in any way really familiar with it. But we looked at the paper, we looked at the area, we both looked at each other and said, "This looks nice," and I wrote a letter that the Hoskins happened to like, and that struck up a correspondence, and we made a visit, and this was in the summer of 1970, and things proceeded from there. And we actually announced in just before Christmas in 1970 that the paper had been sold, and we were the new purchasers, and we took over early in 71.
So you moved up here in 1970?
Yes. Yeah. We actually rented a cottage up. We rented one of Don Hewitt's cottages up on top of Selleck Hill for the first year we were here while we were building our present house.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the impressions I have is that you're a Renaissance man. A newspaper man, a hiker, you certainly lecture, and then I just learned that you're the president of the Rotary Club, and also the other day that you play in a band.
Well,
have I left anything out?
Well, you really want my life history? No, you don't, not that much. My primary interest has been in newspapers, and I've done a number of things that way. I'm one of three living founders of the National Conference of Editorial Writers, which is a flourishing organization that grew out of a seminar at Columbia University in 1947. So it's well established. And I worked with the newspaper groups in Connecticut a good bit, and with the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information particularly. But you mentioned my interest in hiking and perambulating. Mm-hmm. In a fit of whimsy, knowing my love for walking in the mountains, the Board of Selectmen, under then First Selectman Bill Barnett, in the summer of 1973, revived the ancient colonial office of perambulator with the stated duties of walking the bounds of the town every 5 years, presumably to make sure there's been no aggression from Massachusetts or New York, but actually saying to walk these on my own time. It was really partway a gag, but this was all done very seriously in a, I believe it was a town meeting. In any event, the late Don Knowlton dug up a cut from a dictionary of an old pram type perambulator, and he sent it in. And this was sort of the logo of the perambulator, was this pram in here. We printed it in the paper, but this is all done in good fun, and so I changed the name of my column to Perambulating Men, with the idea that I could perambulate on any subject anywhere in the world, really, and this is what I've done. At one time, when Charlotte Reed was first selectman, the other perambulator and I joked about not getting any recompense for our arduous services, and so very, very ostentatiously, the first selectman presented us each with a bottle of rum at a town meeting. it was fun. We did do some actual stuff for the town. We gave reports on the boundary markers, and it fell to me to try to determine whether the eastern boundary of Salisbury was in the middle of the river or on the west bank, and I was able to establish through some records that the original boundary marker was a pile of stones by an apple tree, but on the west bank at the southwest corner, southeast corner. And that conformed to what state records then showed also, but this was in connection with the responsibility for paying for the reconstruction of the bridge at Falls Village. Who had the legal responsibility for it? As it happened, I think the costs were shared, but actually the bridge is in Falls Village.
Okay. I think Bill Doolittle mentioned that you did some research on a sign where New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut...
Oh, the Tri-State Corner. It's not a sign. I had done some hiking up there before I was a perambulator, and I wrote about this, and George Kiefer helped me because he had hiked up in there, but nobody really knew very much about what it was, and we discovered what we thought was the Tri-State Corner, but it didn't say anything about Connecticut on it. It just said New York and Massachusetts. Now, the border at that point is a sort of T-junction, because the border of Massachusetts actually extends out into New York about, half a mile or so beyond the Connecticut boundary, so that Connecticut is on one side of the T, New York on the other, and Massachusetts is on the top all the way across. Well, it developed that Connecticut was too chintzy to pay for its quarter of marking that boundary marker, I think in 1898, whenever it was set out there. Some of them are 1898, some are as late as 1908 in this area. But yes, I did do quite a lot of work trying to run that one down. Julia Petit, in her book about Salisbury, has a photograph that shows an earlier boundary marker in there that is from the 1860s and that is in disrepair now. I wrote Governor Grasso about this and tried to agitate people into doing something about it, and of course nothing ever happened. The State Highway Department, now the Department of Transportation, has the legal responsibility for perambulating the boundaries of the state, but they never tell you when they're coming out here. But Bob Brandegee and I did go along a lot of the boundary markers in Sages Ravine and also along the western boundary with the town of Northeast to locate them. There is one down really on the corner of Indian Lake. You don't realize that Salisbury extends all the way over to Indian Lake, but
right.
It does. Most of them are identifiable. Bill Morrill and I one time were bushwhacking up on top of Round Mountain, and we found what we thought was, well, we found a cairn, a large pile of stones with no reason for being there. And we concluded that this must have been the original 1725 boundary marker, or possibly the 1731 readjustment, that shows on the map, but no, it isn't a regular boundary marker, it's just a pile of stones. Curiously, we've never been able to find it again. We've been up there numerous times, and we can only conclude that this was cannibalized unwittingly by people who cut the red trail up there and put little cairns along it.
Does the name Connecticut now appear on the sign? No. Oh, it still isn't there.
Still isn't there. You have to take this one on faith. There is, of course, the highest point in Connecticut is on the south shoulder of Mount Frizzell, and there is a pipe up there. It's been marked at various times with signs, but I don't think there's anything at the moment there. You just have to know where it is.
Well, you have found all of these places I've been reading about.
Well, only by a lot of trial and error. There's an interesting little bit of history about the tower on Bear Mountain. When we first came here, there was about a 20 or 22 foot tower up on top there, which was in various states of disrepair. And then a couple years after we were here, it started to crumble, and the Salisbury Association restored it through a gift from George Gillette, actually. And it was put back in good order, and Peter Brazzali made a brass lightning rod that went on the thing. Well, over 4 or 5 years, the thing crumbled again, and this time the Darien or New Canaan Boy Scouts rebuilt it as a project, and helicopters came in with building materials and all of this, and it was quite a project. Then it just very badly deteriorated, and I did a good bit of writing about it. Finally, we were instrumental in getting the Commissioner of Environmental Protection to come out and look at it, and he got some state funds, and they stabilized it at about half its height, but it's now a place where hikers can climb on it without fear of breaking a leg or something like that, and it exists. All right, this was commissioned by Robbins Battelle of Norfolk, and it was completed in 1884, and a Salisbury mason named Owen Travis did the construction work on it. It's not at the highest point on Bear Mountain. The actual high point's about 4 feet higher and 300 feet northwest, and I've seen this as speculation. I don't know whether it's true, but the thought is that it was put where it is so that Robbins Battelle could see it from his window in Norfolk. And he commissioned another tower in Norfolk on top of Haystack Mountain, which is quite a little sort of pergola up there, and very attractive. He was an important guy because his daughter, Ellen Battelle Steckel, married Carl Steckel. She was the person who willed her estate to the Yale School of Music, which is still the Yale Summer School of Music. And Carl Steckel founded the Litchfield County University Club. And on one occasion, he brought the New York Philharmonic up by train to play at a dinner of the University Club. Things were done in grand style in those days.
Where is that University Club?
Well, there is no physical facility. No, it just exists. It comprises people of all over the county. Yeah. It's dedicated to good conversation. It meets twice a year, and it funds about $50,000 in scholarships. And,
That's a better job than the Algonquin Club, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, I guess.
Bob, relate your hiking to those, when I saw you taking those kids out on
the
hike.
Well,
what that all
happened
about?
To be that's a little project that the Rotary Club has done for a number of years. The Salisbury Rotary Club is part of District 789. Incidentally, let me make clear, I'm president-elect, but I don't become president until next July. So, Bob Slagle is president this year. The one Rotary project is to sponsor international student exchange. The Rotary Foundation gives fellowships for study abroad to teachers, to people in various walks of life, and these are extremely generous fellowships. They pay for a year's good living and travel, and they're very good things to get hold of. One thing we sponsor is students spending an academic year in high school abroad. And we send Americans to any one of 20-odd countries or so, the cooperating countries, and students from those countries come here. As part of that project, the Salisbury Rotary Club has sponsored a weekend for all the exchange students, foreign exchange students, in the Rotary District 789, which is the northern half of Connecticut and the western half of Massachusetts. And they, 23 or 4 of them, descend on Salisbury and stay with families here, usually Rotary families, for a weekend, and we organize a bebop session and dinners and so forth. But as part of it, I for 10 or 12 years have led them on a hike, usually up Bear Mountain here on Saturday morning, to work some of their energy off. It certainly works some of mine off. Well, this year, it was being a nice day, I changed the route. Bill Morrow has helped me with this for a long time, and we took them up over Round Mountain and Mount Frizzell, and then over to Brace Mountain, New York, and back. So we give them a fair amount of exercise.
How old is this scholarship program? How many years has the Rotary Club done this?
Well, as long as I've known anything about the Rotary, I suppose it's 30 or 40 years old. And they work closely with the American Field Service, and it's quite similar to that in point of fact. But a nicer group of kids you would never meet, and it's so interesting to see how language may be a little barrier, but not much.
Yeah, that's right.
That certainly is right. I want to get back to Lakeville Journal in relation to one question. Can you trace where the Lakeville Journal was before its present location?
Certainly can. Let me say that the Lakeville Journal was started by a man by the name of Carl Card, C-A-R-D, of Millerton, of Northeast. I think he came from Boston Corners originally, but he started this paper in 1897, having already owned the Millerton Telegram. And the first editor was Irving J. Keyes, K-E-Y-E-S. They published in a building near where the barber shop now is on Main Street in Lakeville. And Keyes only stayed, I think he stayed for less than a year, and shortly thereafter, B.D. Jones, Ben Jones, came. And Ben Jones was the longtime editor and publisher later. B.D. Jones bought out Carl Card about 1905 or thereabouts, and then himself remained as editor and publisher until the very late 30s. Not very late, I should guess 36 or 37. Ben Jones died, and a Mrs. Dorothy Belcher took over and ran it for a couple of years, and Ann and Stuart Hoskins bought it from Mrs. Belcher, and they came in 1940 and had a very colorful career here. I'm sure Stuart has made
we have an excellent paper.
Yeah, but so, to answer your question, the journal, I believe, was in two separate buildings adjacent to one another, right on Main Street there. If you remember where the Mayland Chime Company was,
sure.
Well, that was the old Lakeville Journal building at
that
that's point.
That's where Community Fuel is now.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. And, well, is it? No, I think it's, okay. No, I think it's where Nelson Slater has his office now.
It's just going up the hill.
The Community Fuel is right next to the barbershop, isn't it?
But on the other side.
And this was the other side of that. Okay.
And then in 1958, Fred Lubischer had already acquired what is now Pocket Knife Square, and he and the Hoskins came to an agreement whereby the Lakeville Journal took over the major building in the Pocket Knife Square complex. This has been known as the Lakeville Journal building, although the Journal never owned it. But the Journal had the first floor and the basement of the Pocket Knife factory. And then after we came, we persuaded Fred Lubischer to build us a press building between two existing buildings. And the press is now where the press room was, where the main dining room in Holly Place is. We built that as a press room, and it had a web press in it for a long time. We used two existing outside walls, you see, and all we had to do was build the interior and a roof. And then we took over the other buildings, I think, where there are several shops now, was our advertising department for a while. There were various configurations, but the building was occupied by the Journal for 25 years until 1983. We at that point had known that I get a metal block. Ralph Schweikert was buying the building, and he had other plans for it, and he wanted the Journal out.